Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Rabideau, today's lineup of guests were so much fun to talk to. I loved it.
They were. It's an interesting bunch, and I'm going to ask the privilege of introducing the program today, since I didn't get much of a word in edgeways for the rest of the program, because I was surrounded by ladies. So four guests and a co-host, I feel totally outnumbered, but...
As you should.
I can tell you what we've
As
got.
You should.
We've got two people from the South, not originally from the South, but now from the South in North Carolina, talking in different ways about what's cooking down there. And then we've got two people from the Northeastern United States, Joan Nathan and Sarah Moulton, who I'm guessing are probably both from New York City.
Right.
So we've got two Sarahs, an Andrea and a Joan, four wonderful ladies, all with a different take on this wonderful world of cooking.
Chef Andrea Rusing, Peter and I both fell in love with your book, your food, and you reading Cooking in the Moment, A Year of Seasonal Recipes. Congratulations on a very fine book.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
It sort of reads like, well, let's get some things out of the way. First of all, you're in North Carolina, and you also have a restaurant called Lantern, which is predominantly Asian-influenced.
That's right. It's food from all over Asia, but done with a lot of North Carolina ingredients. So we focus mostly on regional Chinese, Thai, Vietnamese, Korean, some Indian, but done with lots of products from North Carolina, including, you know, almost all of our seafood and pork and beef and chicken and amazing vegetables, all from right around here.
Well, you have some really wonderful soft-shell crab recipes. I didn't notice so much, actually, that the Asian influence in the recipes. That is, though, huh?
Well, there's a couple restaurant recipes in the book, but for the most part, it's kind of a diary of home cooking over the course of a year.
Okay, that's the term I was going to ask you to explain, because when you say cooking in the moment, when I started reading it, it reads like a diary of cooking.
Yeah, that's the intention. I think that when I kind of faced with the prospect of do I want to do a cookbook or not, I wasn't very interested in doing a restaurant cookbook because I felt like I really wanted it to be a book that people would use and would be in people's kitchens and be messy and really allow people to kind of look at farmers market ingredients in a way that feels accessible for weeknight dinners. And so that's the book that I wanted to do. And, you know, of course, maybe someday I'll do a restaurant cookbook, but that wasn't what I felt like doing at the time.
Well, it's getting very good reception by a lot of chefs and other people as well. Here's something that has an influence. Asian influence, the warm edamame with 7 spice powder.
There you go, you found that one.
I found that one. And then my other big thrill was I opened it to Birthday Feast, and it was Sunday, July 12th, which is my birthday.
Well, that's also my husband's birthday.
So that's the connection. It's your husband's birthday.
Yeah.
So, but yours is very much around that time, too.
Yeah, mine's 8th.
So anyhow, my proposal is we come there to your restaurant for our mutual birthdays. We have a great big party.
That would be great. We can have a birthday feast.
Yeah. Now, you come from New York, though, or northern New Jersey, is it?
That's right. Yeah, Bergen County, pretty near the George Washington Bridge.
And everybody predicted that you would not be able to get these wonderful ingredients and you'd be miserable in North Carolina.
I think there is a certain chauvinism in New York about food and food culture in New York.
And you think?
And I was as guilty as the next person when I lived there.
Pick out some ideas of the things that you find that are sort of interesting, because we have a lot of cookbooks where they have seasonal ingredients and seasonal menus. What sets yours apart is this sort of in-the-moment feeling you get reading it. But what are some of your most favorite recipes? And they're different, too, aren't they? They're very personal.
Well, right now I think we're doing a lot with shrimp because shrimp are just coming in for us in the South. So there's a great recipe with Anson Mills Carolina Gold rice, although you can use any kind of rice, and shrimp. And we put asparagus in it right now, but you can also put ramps and spring onions and green garlic and peas or fava beans. Really any small, sweet, green thing that you would find available right now in the spring, almost in any part of the country, the soup is a very good kind of catch-all for any spring ingredient.
in the way it's structured here, you have, and they're intriguing titles of these little, what do we call them, like the introductory paragraphs or pages, actually, to the various recipes. And they have great titles such as Good Fat, or, well, you divide it into spring, summer, fall, and winter, of course. But what are some of those other titles? Shelling Party. You know, it's sort of a little out of the ordinary, the way you introduce this. Killing Crabs is another one. And so you have a lot of information for the home cook in it too, right?
Yeah, I feel like that people, our kind of interest in food and foodieism has not necessarily encouraged people to cook any more than they did before. We were totally obsessed with food and knew the names of chefs, and home cooks had signature dishes. And so I think that getting back to this idea of just kind of basic, simple, that people really don't need special expertise to cook dinner, and that's kind of the idea behind the book.
Well, you give me a lot of information that I wouldn't have otherwise had, and a lot of recipes, and we both cook a lot of recipes that I'm not going to let slip by with this book. I'm going to have to investigate.
Oh, good.
So, your cherries. I mean, who knew you could do all those things with cherries? Pickled cherries.
They're very good with, you know, different kinds of cured meats. And this one place where we visit for cherries, Levering Orchard, has 30 different varieties of cherries. And so they've got cherries for a relatively long period of time. And there's lots of different cherries to do different things with. So some are fresh eating cherries, others are sour cherries, some are better for pickling, some are better for stewing. So you get the idea, cherries.
Right. And oysters. You talk about shrimp. Isn't there a huge difference between this farm shrimp and that the wild Carolina shrimp?
I really agree with you, and I think you really taste the difference. The wild shrimp are much, much sweeter, and they have a nicer, less kind of rubbery texture, and they're very delicate, and they're really special. And I think Gulf shrimp is something that really we need to support right now, because, you know, shrimp are going for about $1 a pound on the dock in a lot of the Gulf, and that's not enough money to even go out and catch them.
That's a shame. Isn't it awful, huh? Yeah. Now, you have sauerkraut, you have choucroute in here. We recently interviewed someone about sauerkraut. I mean, it's amazing process, isn't it?
It is, and it's really actually, it's amazing how simple it is, I think, is really the most amazing thing about it, that you can make a brine. The great thing about sauerkraut is it's so simple. You can just make a brine, you put the cabbage in, and if you need to have it in the spot that's the right temperature, but other than that, there's really nothing to it, and 7 to 10 days later, there you have it. It's a really good sauerkraut, better than anything you could buy.
I used to make a choucroute garni, the Julia Child recipe, until my brother-in-law had it and had a heart attack with my goose fat.
Oh, no.
So you do a lot of pickling.
I do. I really love pickles. We use a lot of pickles at the restaurant, but also I think that this idea that you have to have time or energy or interest in canning in order to make pickles or to preserve food is a little bit of a misunderstanding. And in the book, I am encouraging people to do refrigerator pickles and look at food preserving as not just canning, but kind of there's a lot out there.
Now, refrigerator pickles, you don't have to go through this whole thing with the sterilizing jars and things, right?
No, I mean, it's good to have clean things, but other than that, for a couple weeks, a couple months in the fridge, there's no reason to can things.
And you have a lot of chili stuff.
Mm-hmm. I love chili. Love spicy food.
Yeah, the one thing I disagree with is you have this real gorgeous display of heirloom tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And you advise your readers, get your bread and mayo ready. That's not a good tomato sandwich. You've got to have your bread and your butter.
And your butter. I like that idea. I'm not against that.
Well, what besides... is the mantra for just about every chef around. What do you add extra to this thing of local and seasonal and simple?
I think this book is a snapshot of a very vibrant food community, and there's great vignettes about why grass-fed is important, but it's not done in a sidebar. You know, it's done in a narrative as part of a story. in the life of two cheesemakers and as they've become farmers. So that's one example of kind of what I think the approach of the book is, to kind of show what goes on here in this very rich, dense food world.
Well, you certainly succeed at it, because that's how, exactly the message that we took away from it.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
And these people are people who have become your friends, too, by the sound of it.
That's true, and I think it made it a challenge sometimes to write about people, because everyone in the book, every narrative is involving friends, and so you have to be careful.
I see, okay. I was intrigued to read, you have one section about a farm where they make pigs, and you have a nice way of describing pork as it grows on pigs.
That's my friend Sylvia Pajola, who opened, we've been together for a long time, since before we opened the restaurant, but she is from Austria, and that's the idea. If she ever writes her own cookbook, she already knows the title.
It's a great title.
Pork is a fruit, it grows on pigs.
Now, you mentioned in the same little, on the same page, a doctor who's a friend or a husband, I can't remember which it is, he's growing Red Devon cattle.
Oh, yep, that's right.
And we've had Red Devon cattle beef.
Oh, good. Did you like it?
But it was in Devon. it's absolutely, truly wonderful. Is there a lot of that heirloom breed thing sort of stuff going on in North Carolina?
I think there is in terms of some animals. I think, you know, we have Asabah hogs, as I mentioned in the book, and there's also another dual purpose, which means for your listeners, King, and also for meat animals before kind of factory meat production, were designed to be more multi-use, so not designed, but were genetically selected to be more multi-purpose. So if a farm had a line of cows, the cows were good for milk, but they were also good for meat. And so you mentioned the Red Devon. This is also true of the Red Poll, which is another breed that's pretty popular here. And I think the thing about heirlooms in general, whether it's produce or animals, is that it can have kind of a dusty, antique, kind of fussy quality to it when you're just hearing about it for the first time and you haven't tasted some of these things. But really, so much of this, most of it, is really about flavor and getting food on the table quickly. You can do it much more efficiently when you have very, very flavorful products. And so I'm trying to come at it in the book from the perspective of these things are the tastiest things.
I thought it was fascinating. I think you had another story of some people who started a farm and it took them 4 years to get it to the point where they could cultivate it.
Right.
Because for the first 2 years they just let goats loose to do the job of clearing the undergrowth.
Yeah, that was quite amazing. And they're really into vegetables now. I think it's their sixth or seventh year. Well, actually, it might be like their eighth or ninth year farming, but it's their fourth or fifth year with doing some vegetables. And so they're doing a lot more, and it's really great to see their farm.
So for those people who are not in your particular neck of the woods in North Carolina, I guess the objective would be to try to develop the same kinds of relationships that you've developed in your local area, and then you can go to town with the cook.
Well, I feel that people don't always know what's around them, and there's a lot more around them often than you know. There's a lot more around me than I knew when I moved here from New York, and so discovering that is something that's just extra bonus on top of the flavorful food and how much more local food can bring to your cooking.
Well, you certainly provide lots and lots of enthusiasm in your book, lots of things that will get people thinking, and we're so glad that we had the chance to talk to you about this today.
Do you have a website you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I do. It's lanternrestaurant.com.
And listeners, this is a keeper, this book.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Delightful. Don't forget, Friends Forever.
Yes, July birthdays. We got to do that dinner.
Okay, Andrea, thank you so much.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. And we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
It's a curious thing that we should interview in such a close proximity to each other, two ladies who live in close proximity to each other, because our next guest is Sarah Foster, who has dining establishments in both Durham and Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and the subject of her book is Southern Cooking.
Sarah Foster's Southern Kitchen.
There you go.
Soulful, traditional, seasonal.
Okay. So here we go, Sarah.
Sarah Foster, renowned Foster's Market, is also a cookbook author, but in this cookbook it is different, isn't it, Sarah, that you actually returned to your southern roots to write this book?
Yes, this is one of my favorite books of all my four cookbooks, and it's just out. And
it's beautiful. I understand now why everyone was raving about it. It's just beautiful, the photographs, everything. And it's called Sarah Foster's Southern Kitchen, and subtitled Soulful, Traditional, and Seasonal.
Yeah, right. And I feel like the subtitle really sums it up. This book has a little bit of something for everyone. It has the traditional recipes, which were a lot of my family recipes, like my grandmother's and my mother's and my dad's. But it also has some newer recipes that are kind of my take on Southern food, which tends to be a little lighter, a little fresher. I tend to cook my greens closer to 4 minutes than to 4 hours.
Yeah, I like that. You have that in the book. I like that part of it.
Yeah,
although Peter cooks his greens.
Yeah, but you like collard greens done for a long time. Most of the other greens she doesn't, but I started experimenting with cooking collard greens for about 20 to 25 minutes, and Anne says she likes them better that way.
Yeah, a lot of people do. I think it's just a matter of taste. I kind of like mine more like stir-fried and cooked really quickly with just a little bit of olive oil and maybe some nice diced country ham to give it a little flavor.
And vinegar.
Yeah, and vinegar.
Yeah,
you got to have that good pot liquor, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There seems to be a sort of a revival going on of Southern cook. This is not the only Southern cooking book that's crossed our site recently, and there are some restaurants like Sean Brock's Husk in Charleston, South Carolina, just opened.
Yeah, right. I love that place.
I do too.
There too. That's
right. And where he says he's got to the original roots of Southern cuisine and rediscovering ingredients that were always there, and then figuring out how to use them properly. And it seems like you're doing the same thing. Although you're memorializing family recipes, you're also making sure that people get to take advantage of this wonderful Southern larder.
Well, you sort of touched ground with that I was going to ask is, we've seen so many supposedly definitive Southern cookbook. What is it that sets this book apart from all these other Southern cooking books?
Well, I agree with Sean. I feel like that we are really going back to our roots. I feel like Southern cooking has really become full circle. And by that I mean that our grandparents' generation and my mother's generation, they cooked what we now call farm to fork. They did that out of necessity because they didn't really have the luxury to buy red peppers in January from California. And I feel like that we now do it because it's a huge food movement that's, you know, across the country. And it's great to see everyone on board for it. It's great to see everyone getting back to eating locally and seasonally. But I think really what makes my book different is it kind of has a combination of both of that. It has the traditional elements that we all love about Southern food, like fried chicken and barbecue.
Yeah, I was going to say, fried chicken, what distinguishes or separates out your fried chicken from the 10 million other fried chicken recipes I have?
Well, this fried chicken is my grandmother's fried chicken recipe, and I, of course, think it's fabulous. I think it's a really great recipe. It's really simple. I think what makes it extra special is you brine the chicken for overnight, and then that way you brine it in like a water, herb, a little bit of vinegar, salt, and sugar, and let it just sit in that overnight. And it helps keep the chicken really, really moist and really succulent, and it adds a lot of flavor to it.
So that's an original old-fashioned technique, brining, huh?
Yeah, I think they used to do it because chickens were probably a lot fresher, and it probably, you know, like my grandmother used to go out in her backyard and kill her chicken.
Right, you said
that. You know, after they drain the blood out of it, it probably helped get a little more of that blood out of it, too.
Uh-huh.
So I think that was part of the process. But I think it also adds a lot of flavor to it as well.
Now, this book is a whole lot more than just recipes. I mean, you have Sarah special tips.
You've sidetracked this where you get the little hints of things.
I'm talking about among the recipes themselves. There are hints, suggestions, variations that you have thought about.
Yeah, I like to give a lot of information in my book, so I have a lot of sidebars. I have a sidebar called On the Side where I tell you about different things to serve with a dish, like what dishes go well together. I have another one called Know-How that teaches you how to do things like cut a chicken into 10 pieces or blanch vegetables, and then I have some things for people that may not be from the South, like
chew on this.
a sidebar called, yeah, Chew on This. And then that's about things that you might not know about unless you lived in the South, like what are pole beans and what are snap beans and how, you know, where did grits come from and things like that. So it's a lot of great information.
Yeah, and Sarah Swaps, that's a good one too.
Yeah, I love that one too. Because this book is and talking about cooking seasonally, and obviously we can't always do that. So, for instance, if you can't get pink-eyed peas and you want to make the pink-eyed pea and roasted sweet potato salad, give you different other beans that you can use. Like that would be great with black beans or navy beans. So I like to try to give people different ideas of how to switch out things if they aren't in season.
Now, are these a reflection of the kinds of things that you cook at your restaurants?
Yes, a lot of them are. A lot of them are things that we would cook at Foster's Market, like a lot of the salads and a lot of the sides and some of the main dishes. But a lot of them are my family recipes. Like there's a whole chapter on pickles and condiments.
Oh, I love that chapter.
Yeah.
In fact, when we were at Husk, the thing that knocked me, I just absolutely adored his pickled green tomatoes.
Oh, yeah, those are great.
Oh, yeah, because my mother used to make those, and I miss them.
Well, yeah, so I kind of rediscovered pickling. I mean, I used to do that with my grandmother when I was younger, and I hadn't done it in years because I think I was like most people. I just thought it was way too time-consuming and kind of daunting. And when I started doing it, I was like, this is really easy. And really, last summer, I was pickling everything from radishes to carrots to cucumbers to tomatoes.
Huh? It's a big business now. I mean, they have whole companies that sell nothing but jarred pickles.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of my favorite chapters. And it was fun kind of taking my grandmother's recipes and trying to figure out what she meant by 5 cents worth of mustard stew.
Yes, I have, you know, I have some old recipes like that, too. It calls for things like a jar of grape jelly.
Right, exactly.
Now, my next question is going to invite you into a Haig family controversy. Just so you're aware of it.
Okay.
Which is the way that you say that I think your father or your grandfather used to like his steak.
Oh, yeah, in the skillet.
In the skillet with olive oil.
Yep.
And
yep.
Mrs. Haig thinks that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. She says, why would you do that?
Now, when Mrs. Haig says, you're sabotaging my efforts to control my weight if you have to cook absolutely every single thing in the world in olive oil and lots of it if you don't happen to have bacon fat. He's English. Everything's in bacon fat.
Come on, Sarah. You have to step up and back me up here.
Those are two different arguments. So, yeah, you've got to have just a little bit of oil. But the secret to that is the cast iron skillet.
That's exactly what I use.
Yeah, if you have a really good cast iron skillet, you don't need a lot of oil.
Thank you.
You don't get very much oil, for heaven's sake. All I did with the tuna last night was crushed coriander seeds and then just enough grapeseed oil to make them stick to the tuna.
Oh, that sounds good.
And that was it. It's exactly the same thing as I'm doing with the steak. In fact, I have to cook steak on Monday. And I'm already dreading the complaints that I'm going to get about the extra calories I'm adding to the food.
Well, it's not without the olive oil. I mean, often I cook it, you know, if you're concerned about that, don't even put olive oil in it. If you have a really good seasoned cast iron skillet.
That's what we have. We have my grandmother's cast iron skillet.
And you got a nice marbled steak. You probably don't need the
Thank
olive
you.
Oil.
Thank you.
But I was delighted to see that I'm not the only one who feels that this is the right way to sear a steak.
Right, and yeah. then my father would top it off with a big slab of butter as well.
Yes, right.
Well, I don't do that, although I could be tempted since we have some black and white truffle butter in our refrigerator right now. So maybe I'll do that just on my part of the steak.
That's directly a compromise.
In your side trap section, how did you find these? I mean, I was so thrilled to see Cochon Butcher's in there. I mean, I just love him, and Donald Blank, and I love that shop.
Yeah, that's a great shop, isn't it? Well, I think Southerners are known for their going out of the way to have something great to eat, and I grew up that way. I mean, I grew up in Jackson, Tennessee, and there was a barbecue place, which is also in the book, called Bozo's.
I'm just looking at it.
my family made a trip to Memphis, we would have to stop at Bozo's and have barbecue. So.
Yeah, it looks just perfectly wonderful. Bozo's Hot Pit Barbecue.
Yeah. So I thought it would be really interesting to share with people some of my favorite places to eat, like Cochon Book and Bozo's and T.W. Graham's. And there are just so many great places that I think you can go and get really unique things that are kind of just small places that sometimes you may have to drive 15 or 20 minutes off of your main path, but definitely worth it for a good piece of pie, right?
Yes.
No, is this sort of one of these things where you're driving down the road and you impose the parking lot test. So if you see this shack by the side of the road that you've never seen before, but you look in the parking lot and see lots of cars there, you know that it must be worth going to?
Yes, absolutely. That's definitely a good way to find those places.
Now, you have a recipe for Carl's Deep Fried Turkey. Now, I thought deep fried turkey was something more recent than what you're writing about.
Well, I'm writing about new things and old things. So Carl's Deep Fried Turkey, yeah, that's definitely a newer thing. Like when I was growing up, we never had deep fried turkey, but I think it's certainly a southern thing now. And Carl is one of my friends that's a minister. And every Thanksgiving, he makes deep fried turkeys for about 15 women in his church because they like to do the deep fried turkey because it frees their oven up to make all the side dishes.
Right.
But the problem is that it's also a risky proposition, I understand, if you haven't really done it before.
Well, I think if you have the right equipment and you're doing it outside, it's pretty easy to do, but you definitely want to have the right equipment and the right place to do it. I think it would be hard to do it if you were in an apartment in a city.
You know, the other thing, I'd never actually noticed this, I mean, I didn't think about it, that you point out is that breakfast is a really special meal in the South, and much more than it is in any other part of the country.
Yeah, and for me, breakfast is one of those meals that I feel like you can have any time of the day.
Uh-huh.
I think you can, like when I was growing up, we often had breakfast for dinner. You know, we would have eggs and bacon and grits for dinner, and it was always just a treat, you know, something to look forward to.
Yeah, Sarah Moulton, I think she's a whole book out for that, or she does have a presentation for that.
No, yeah, she has a book called Breakfast for Dinner,
yeah,
I think that's what it's called.
See, I think it's a great idea. I mean, and I also, in my book, a lot of the dishes that are in the breakfast chapter could easily be a dinner dish, like the roasted asparagus with country ham and poached eggs topped with red-eyed gravy. I mean, doesn't that sound like the perfect dinner?
It does indeed.
It sounds pretty good for a mid-morning snack, too.
Yeah, so it could be either. You know, it could be breakfast or dinner or brunch.
Well, I must say that, we've covered some of the territory in this book. It's just so rich in detail and information that we can't cover all of it. But it's certainly a nice fresh take on what has become a major trend is Southern food. Once again, it's back in the spotlight. And you've done an incredible job on this book, Sarah Foster.
Well, thank you.
And if you travel the South, you should buy this book just to know where it is that Sarah Foster goes to eat, because all your secrets are in here.
Right. And also, and don't forget to stop by Foster's Market. And you have where is it now again?
We have a location in Durham, North Carolina.
And in
Chapel Hill as well.
In Chapel Hill.
And what do you do when Duke and North Carolina play basketball?
Oh, my goodness. That's a tough decision.
Do you close?
Everyone is either a Duke fan or a UNC fan.
It's a curious thing. In my work at Duke a number of years ago, was to do with their communications networks, and they said it was absolutely amazing how many network faults there were on the days when Duke and North Carolina were playing each other, especially if the wrong team won.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. College basketball is a big deal here.
It's a religion, correct?
Yeah, definitely.
Keep up that religion.
And once again, the book is Sarah Foster's Southern Kitchen, Soulful, Traditional, and Seasonal. Thank you for joining us, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
And stay with us. We'll be back on the other side of this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Joe Nathan, our next guest, is practically an institution. She's just one of the most respected cookbook authors, and that includes her, the research she goes into it, her skills at writing, the perfection of her recipes. And she's going to be talking to us today about her latest book called Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous. So let's listen to Joan Nathan. I'm going to ask you, Joan Nathan, how many cookbooks you've written, and you probably don't even know because you've written so many.
I've written 10, actually.
Okay, and this one is 11?
No, it's 10.
10. And it's Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous.
Right.
Subtitled, which I think this leads us into our discussion here, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France.
Exactly.
And this is so thoroughly researched a book, it's hard to figure out how I can convey that in this brief interview. You start with a long history of Jews in France, mm-hmm. and it goes way, way back.
Right. It surprised me, and I think it goes even farther back than I said. Jews have been living in France for 2,000 years.
Amazing.
And the first Jews that came over that were written facts were the Jews that came with the Romans after the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem. And they came to Rome. Some stayed in Italy. Some went to Catalonia and Spain, which was also France. And others just went to the south of France. And sometimes when I would ask people in France, well, where are your parents from? Where are your ancestors from? And they'd say France. And to a Jew living in America, I thought, what?
Yeah.
And I kept saying, well, aren't they from someplace else? No, they're from France.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but 2,000 years, I guess, is a long time.
Or maybe they're from Spain and they've only been in France for about 900 years.
Right. Well, no, but they were living near Marseille, all over the south of France. And I believe that they probably came earlier, because I think with the destruction of the Second Temple, Jews were already roaming the Mediterranean as merchants, as peddlers, looking for new products, because Jews have always been merchants. There's just no question about it. And throughout history, they stayed in France, and they went north in boats looking for goods, looking for spices, looking for even carp, freshwater fish that they could use on the Rhone River. They went to China and brought it back. After the Inquisition, the Jews called the Portuguese merchants brought chocolate back from the New World to France.
But now, how should we characterize this book? Is it a piece of social history? Is it a cookbook? What kind of combination of the two was it supposed to be?
Well, I think it's a cookbook with a lot of social history. In other words, every recipe, I thought about the recipe. I thought about where it came from, who ate it. They're not just recipes. For example, I had one recipe with a bain-marie, which of course is like a boiling water bath that you cook certain foods in. And I learned that bain-marie was originally bain-marie la juive, which was sort of a woman in about the 3rd century who was able to make hot water into a bath. And she was considered not a witch, but sort of, what's the word, somebody who can change things. And I learned that that was the original word for this, la juive, meaning Jewish Mary.
Wonderful.
And I learned about foie gras and the Jewish role in foie gras in France. First of all, Romans.
Well, that's an interesting story. Can you tell
about Jews? The thing is that Jews in France, when Jews first went to France, everybody used olive oil, and they lived in the south of France. And then as they moved farther north, they started using, they needed goose fat because Jews didn't use lard, and there was no olive oil in places like Alsace or Champagne. So the Jews produced force feeding of geese because they needed the fat. But a byproduct of that, of course, was the foie gras, and then the two other byproducts were goose feathers for pillows and for duvets, and also quills for pens.
Oh, yeah.
So Jews had always been in the goose feather business and were known as great producers of foie gras, which I doubt if most Jews used foie gras. They probably used chicken liver, chopped chicken liver instead, because there's so much blood in a liver that you would have to get rid of the blood. People used to think of liver as the soul of man, and to make it kosher, it would get hard just the way chopped liver is, and you lubricate chopped liver with eggs and fat, and then you have a wonderful little
chopped pâté. And that was something that originated in Alsace, and it moved east to Eastern Europe.
Now, you have a couple of other very rich sources of information. One is a more of a rich historical source, which is the fate of the Jewish population of France in the years from 1940 to 1945, and then another period of the return, I guess, to France of Jews who had settled in Algeria after Algeria
right.
became independent of France. Can you talk a little bit about those two waves?
Because right.
They're both heavily represented in the book.
Right. Well, before I even say that, the reason that I have mentioned this historic facts is that it's so important to understanding the Jewish food in a country, because Jewish food is not just Jewish food, it's people. And World War II was such an important part of France and of the makeup of the Jewish community today. And I think that it took me a long time to write this book because people weren't talking. People weren't talking when I was much younger, when I first went to France. And then they started talking just in the past 10 years or so with all the movies that have been coming out. And so what happened between 1940 and 1945, of course, was 83,000 Jews were put, they used the expression, ils ont disparu, they disappeared mm-hmm. in the concentration
right.
camps at Auschwitz. And they were, largely with the help of the French police, were taken away and just disappeared. And I had chilling stories from people.
Yeah, I might interject here that you made a lot of connections because you're fluent in the language, which
right.
gave you, because almost everything you research is done through people.
It's done through people, and I truly believe that people connect to you better if you speak a language, and
oh,
I am
sure.
fluent in French. In addition, I had relatives in Annecy who they were a very big family and had other relatives all over France or knew people all over France, so I always mm-hmm. asked them before I went to a part of France. And then in addition, I had a very good friend to whom the book was dedicated who died young, who was from another big family, so that I was able to, through their relatives, get invited to homes, which is very rare in France. Sometimes when I speak, I ask, how many of you have been to people's homes in
uh-huh.
France? And they all look sort of startled because it's rare. I mean, even for me, a lot of times people met me in cafes
uh-huh.
until they talked with me a little bit and realized that I was for real. But even then, some people they would not open their home to me.
We actually got invited to somebody's home, and it was the most unusual combination of backgrounds. I mean, he was, of course, French
mm-hmm.
And Catholic, and she was an Iraqi Jew who had lived in Israel, and then
wow.
Dispersed, and her whole family dispersed.
He worked for IBM.
Yeah,
wow.
She was an artist.
But he cooked.
Oh, really? Where did they live?
Where were they?
Someplace
I'd never been before. It's
I remember we went there on the bus.
It was like a suburban.
Well, you know, the thing is that there are all kinds of Jews and all kinds of combinations of couples in France. And today, the Jewish population is the third largest in the world after Israel and the United States. There are 600,000 Jews. And
you tie it directly in this book to the food.
Yeah, exactly.
And also tie it in with holidays, so the people who are looking for holiday dishes are going to be really thrilled to look at some of these recipes.
Well, we're right now just making some of the recipes. As you speak, I hope you can smell it in my kitchen.
Oh.
We're making some of the recipes for Passover and going to freeze them.
Uh-huh.
But we have the brisket that's being done from Daniel Rose in Paris.
Yeah, I didn't know about him. That was an interesting story.
We have a very interesting.
We know about him, but she has a little.
I saw it.
Okay.
I saw it. But we tried to get in touch with him the last time we were going
yeah.
to Paris.
Oh, it's sometimes
and
difficult.
You can't get in.
He never responded.
He never responds.
No. Yeah, right.
And we just made the pineapple flan. And
well, you have preserved lemons. You have all kinds of Middle Eastern
right.
things here, too. You have Moroccan, a tagine, a chicken with prunes, apricots, and almonds. And I guess what I'm trying to point out is, in addition, mind you, to all the wonderful history and all the great character portraits, you also have really delicious recipes.
Oh, yeah, they're really good. and also, half the Jewish population today, you were asking about North Africans, they are from North Africa, from Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. And they have really added to the repertoire of French cuisine. In fact, in most cases, I would say in all cases, where there's a North African Jew and an Eastern European Jew or an Ashkenazic Jew,
yeah,
it's the Sephardic food that just takes over in France. And to the extent that some of the Alsatian Jewish couples or cooks came to me pleading to find the old recipes before it's too late.
Now, you did find old recipes. How did you find them?
Well, I looked in a lot of old books. I actually found a professor who, Jewish, from Tunisia, whose sort of pastime is looking at old Jewish cookbooks in France, and old cookbooks and finding references to the Jews. So he was very helpful to me.
So you have 12th century recipes in here.
Right. Yeah, and then, of course, people pass down their recipes to me. Like, one of them, which is really delicious, is a haroset from France, and which is served at Passover. It's like a fruit and nut paste. And when I interviewed these people, these from an old, old Sephardic Jewish family, Spain or Portugal, they said they would not, which is, happens a lot, by the way, with some of the old the Spanish and Portuguese Jewish families, they wouldn't give me the recipes.
Oh, really?
But they'd give me the haroset recipe because they didn't consider it a recipe, and absolutely delicious. And then another man gave me a recipe for a chocolate cake that had come down in his family, and then he was sort of angry about my book. I don't know why. I mean, it just was a little bizarre. So I had to change the recipe slightly, but I used the recipe.
Well, why do you think they were so guarded about sharing recipes?
I don't know if it's, well, there are a lot of reasons people are guarded. Some of the time, but usually with me, they're not guarded because they know that I'm going to create immortality for them. But I think a lot of people don't want to share their recipes because they think that nobody will come to their house anymore.
And they never invited you to their house anymore.
Right, exactly.
Nobody said their point of view had to make any sense.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
The French, remember?
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so I just got all kinds of recipes, and you know, I always feel as if writing a cookbook is like going fishing. You never know what you're going to reel in. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I've been doing this for long enough time that I realize when recipes are going to be good and when they're not going to be good.
Well, this is a winner, and I wish you a lot of luck with it. Went through it, read through it. I thought to myself, boy, if I had written this, I would end up with a great sigh of relief when I was finally filed.
No, I really didn't want it to end. I had so much fun writing this book.
The only thing that you need to be aware of, listeners, is this is not a diet cookbook.
No.
but the recipes are not fattening. You know, they're really good.
I didn't say they weren't good.
What did your mother keep saying?
My mother kept saying, it's only a cookbook, finish already.
So have you started on your next one?
No, I'll tell you, I'm really reveling in this book, the way that people are reacting to it.
Okay.
And it's made me very busy, and I'm also working on something with the First Lady on sort of initiatives with different ethnic groups and food.
Oh, that's good. That's wonderful to hear.
So it's really fun, and I think that what this book has done, it's the reaction in France has been very strong as well.
Is it available in French?
It's not available in French yet, but the book is in France, and Amazon in France is doing very well with it. It's already in its second printing, just never been a book like this done in France.
Well, it's certainly, I mean, it's a really extraordinary accomplishment.
Well, thank you.
So anyhow, everyone, Joan Nathan's newest book is Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France, and this you have to get. Joan, thank you for talking
to
us. And keep us posted.
Okay, I will. Thank you very much.
Bye, Joan.
Bye.
And we'll be right back after we take a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to our final segment. And the next guest has been on the program several times. Sarah Moulton is a name that everyone in the food business surely knows, and she's always up to something new and exciting.
Sarah Moulton, you're an old friend, not an old friend, you were a friend who I've known for some time now, and you have so much energy that I just need to occasionally stop and talk to you and have you bring me up to date on what all you're doing.
Well, geez, I don't feel like I have so much energy these days. But
oh, you're dynamite. You know that. Tell me this. Let's start with your latest book.
It's called Sarah Moulton's Everyday Family Dinners,
okay.
And it came out last year. And it's sort of a continuation of my second book in that it's all about getting dinner on the table during the work week. I think that's what I'm going to just continue to focus on because it's so important and it's such an issue for families. Everybody thinks, oh, wow, I'm just not going to be able to make dinner on a weeknight. And yet I know that they can because I did for years, even though I worked full-time. I worked at Gourmet Magazine. I'd come home at 5:30 or 6, and we still managed to eat dinner five nights a week fairly soon after I got home. So I figured out all these tips and tricks and strategies for getting an almost-from-scratch dinner on the table, which is so much healthier than using processed and canned food.
Well, so you keep writing cookbooks, and tell me all the other things you're doing. You're negotiating for a new TV show?
Yes, the second season of my public television show, which was called Sarah's Weeknight Meals. And it's not a great climate to be trying to raise money, particularly when we started, which was a couple years ago. The recession really hit. But now we're getting awfully close. Uh-huh. And so hopefully we'll be taping that this summer. It will be airing in October.
In a way, that's on a similar theme to the book.
Yes, it's all about getting dinner on the table during the work week. So it's all entrees. And you know what I tried to do in the last two of my cookbooks and on this show is rethink dinner because we all tend to bore ourselves, make the same boring 10 dishes over and over and over again.
Right.
And so I thought, well, you know, I was brought up with a sort of traditional protein, starch, vegetable, but you don't have to do that. Why not have soup for supper or a substantial sandwich or breakfast for dinner? And that's what I've done in this book. I have different kinds of chapters, mostly, but then I have some of the traditional poultry meat, definitely vegetarian, and side dish chapters. But it's really firmly focused on entrees and sometimes and mostly entrees in which everything's packed in so you don't have to make too much else.
One pot, which is the trend too, right?
Right, right. Which
one pot.
But not entertaining. Not that people couldn't use these recipes for entertaining, but mm-hmm. I think if more people ate dinner at home at least five nights a week, that right there would start solving the obesity problem. It's when you get all this takeout and all this processed food that you sort of get into trouble and extra calories.
We need to get a copy of this book. Can you talk to your publicist and have her send one out?
Oh, absolutely.
Because we need to get to our son and daughter-in-law because I think the only time they have an evening meal of the kind you'd recognize as a meal is when we visit.
Oh, dear.
And that's usually because we cook it.
Well, they have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old and both work.
but they don't have a thing called a meal.
Right.
It's sort of like a movable feast of whatever Kate and PJ will actually put in their mouths so they're not hungry.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think a lot of people are in that situation. You know, they've gotten into the mindset, and I don't blame them, that it's just impossible. And I know it's not impossible. So that's why I focus on that with my show, too. So we'll do 20 episodes. Generally, I do 14 by myself, and then the other 6 I get in people from different nationalities.
That's good.
So I had Mater Joffrey, this is the last round, I had her doing Indian meals.
Oh, great.
I had my friend Roberto Santibanez doing Mexican main dishes. I had my friend Jasper White doing fish dishes. I can do fish dishes, but Jasper's an expert, so why not? So it's sort of fun. And it brings other flavors and other people to the mix.
You really have your finger on the pulse of trends going on. What do you think are some of the more notable trends in our great foodie revolution and the way our relationship food right now?
Well, I think people are getting even more extreme in sort of their grassroots back to the earth movement. I mean, now people are getting permit in major cities to have beehives and raise chickens.
Oh, we have them all over town, right?
Yes, and I think that's increasing. And more the farmers markets and the CSAs, and it's just increasing. Veganism, I think, is really, you know, exploding.
Yeah, I mean, when you have Mario Batali come out and support Meatless Mondays, I think that's pretty
amazing. I know. I wonder if he personally supports Meatless Mondays.
I don't know.
But, yeah, you know, then it's wild. And oh, it's sort of young people cooking and having fun. I mean, obviously, butchering is huge. I was just reading the New York Times Wednesday section, and among other classes that are going to be held, if you pay $2,100, you can go for, I forget if it's 4 or 5 sessions at this butcher shop called Fleischmann's up the Hudson.
Yeah, I know it, yeah.
Get a couple of meals each time. You know, and at the end of the day, I'm thinking to myself, well, I mean, certainly it's much more affordable if you break down meat yourself, but how many people are really going to go get a whole lamb or a side of beef or any large hunks of meat, and where are they going to find them anyway in order to be able to break them down? So at the end of the day, is it really necessary for you personally to learn how to butcher something? I mean, I think it's great that we have good old-fashioned butchers and butcher shops coming back, and certainly I learned a lot about that when I was at the Culinary Institute, but do I really need to go and learn how to break down a whole lamb? I don't think so.
Well, you know, they sell out these classes. I mean, they absolutely sell out.
But it's true. I mean, yes, I believe you. I think this whole, like, artisanal back to starting from absolute scratch, you know, making your own butter, making your own cheese. That's just getting bigger, making your own bread, making artisanal bread. I'm attempting to make this 27-page country bread from the Tartine Cookbook.
Oh, really?
And somebody challenged me to do it. Actually, at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival, I saw Kim Severson from the New York Times. And I told, she asked me what was I doing now that there was no more Gourmet magazine. And I told her all the things I was up to. And I said, plus I have a few hobbies, and one of them is going to be making bread. Because I don't do it on a regular basis. But I thought I'm going to start really doing it. And she said, okay.
27 pages.
I've got a job for you. So I ordered the book. I got the book. And I already broke rule number one, which is to read through the whole recipe before you start. But I thought, I'm just going to get started. So I did. You start by making a starter, you know, which will... wild yeast, you know.
Catch what, the yeast.
I wonder what wild yeast is roaming through my New York City apartment. I'm not sure. But anyway, I did the first round, and things seemed to be going well. It seemed to be looking like it was supposed to. And then after 2 to 3 days, you were supposed to take it out, feed it, take it out, discard some of it, replenish it, feed it, and then let it go, you know, another 24 hours, and then you're supposed to keep doing that. Well, after 24 hours, it looked like it was completely dead. Somewhere in there, I killed it. Let's start all over again.
Well, I have that book. Maybe you and I should challenge each other and see if we can do it first.
And you said the recipe is 27 pages long?
Yes, it is.
Oh, my God.
What, yes, I mean, granted, there are lots of pictures, but it's a little bit vague, you know, as a as an extreme recipe writer. On the one hand, there is more detail than you'd ever want to know. On the other hand, it's a little vague. Like, so for me, they say, take a small glass bowl and put in equal amounts of this flour mixture and water. Well, fine, but how much of each?
Oh, sort of like my great-grandmother's recipe.
Yes, I mean, so it's very, so, but in some ways, though, that makes it even more of a challenge because I'm like, well, I'm not such a literal cook, or, you know, I'm not even a baker, so if I'm a cooker, I should be able to take this sort of vague language and make it work. Cookers, as we know, are less precise than bakers. So I have to go back to the drawing board and start over again.
Oh, dear.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyhow, so
maybe she really doesn't want to give away the secret, huh?
No, I'm sure it's a very accomplished baker from California.
He's actually, his schedule is, I have the book, but we haven't been able to schedule him on the show because he's so busy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's trying to make bread. He's trying to make
his
recipe.
He's busy with all these starters, yeah.
He only got page 24.
Right.
You're always flying around someplace. What do you fly around to do?
Well, it's interesting. When I worked at Gourmet Magazine, I was mostly flying around to represent Gourmet at various events or to work with a client at various events. Now, I'm free agent now that there's no more Gourmet, so I'd go to a food festival or get a job doing a quote-unquote speaking engagement, which means that I'm doing a cooking demo at some event or at a casino. Or just recently I was on a cruise for a week doing many demos.
How
I was in Celebrity Cruise, The Eclipse.
And that was fun?
It was really fun. Actually, I'm not a cruise person at all, but it was a very nice, elegant ship. The food was good. We really relaxed. I brought the husband. It's very rare not to check internet or phone, but we didn't. And
oh,
I have to say, that was a huge vacation right there. But it was my favorite kind of work in that I gave hands-on cooking classes for small groups of 14 or to 17. I did one large demo for about 150 people. I did one dinner. I was involved in one cook-off. But all of the events were small enough that you get to talk to people and meet people and find out what they're doing, what they're cooking, what their issues are. And that's what I love to do. So that's the kind of things I do. But I also have been working with a company called Chantal that makes this copper fusion line of cookware.
Right.
And they sponsored my book tour last year. And we really had such a good time together. I mean, I went to about
25 cities around the country, including Anchorage, Alaska. And I went to little mom-and-pop cookware shops, which, by the way, have survived the recession just fine. And that was great.
Good.
And so we continued the relationship this year. So I'm going out again in May to Santa Fe and Tulsa and Reno and California. And,
that's good.
Yeah, so it's all good.
Tell me this. What happened to all the other people who were on Gourmet staff?
Well, Ruth Reichel is at Random House in charge of all cookbooks.
And she's going to be taking over that guilt thing?
I guess. I don't know. You probably know something I don't know.
It's going to be the food magazine of her dreams. You better make a note of that.
Okay.
They haven't announced it yet.
What is guilt?
It's a luxury, I don't even know what you call it, luxury concept.
How is this spelled? G-I-L-T or G-U-I-L-T?
G-I-L-T.
Okay. Right.
And it's an actual magazine?
I don't know. It's very vague. I've been reading about it in places like Eater, and all the stuff I've been reading about really centers around, is Ruth going to get this job offer and put together this magazine, which I have this idea that it's a magazine, but it's also going to have a strong internet presence.
Huh. And who's the publisher?
I don't know. Guilt.
Very interesting. Well, maybe she'll collect all the people that did work for her, and they'll all come back into the fold.
That's why I mentioned it. I just wondered. Yeah. Do you know who's Ruth Bourdin?
It's a combination. It's somebody who, I don't know who's doing it. The combination of Anthony and Ruth, I don't know.
You don't know? She thinks it's somebody who was once a judge on Top Chef show.
She thinks so?
That's what she said.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know who it might
be. Who cares? If they can't even put their name on it, who cares what they have to say?
Well, the character's up for the column, the online website stuff, is up for a James Beard Award this year.
Well, I should hope they come
the
to this.
Humor. It's the first time they ever... Oh, I think it's hysterically funny.
Yeah, I haven't read it that much, yeah.
I haven't read it at all, and I don't feel like I missed anything.
Oh, but it's funny. It's really funny.
There's something fundamentally dishonest about publishing something that you don't say it's you.
But one of the things is, if in fact it wins and somebody stands up to accept the award, we might find out who it is, but then it would kill it. So what else would you like to tell all your fans out there, Sarah?
Oh, well, I'm working on an iPhone app.
Yeah, what's that going to be about?
Well, it's like a mini cookbook. It's 60 recipes, 60 photos, and 10 videos. And most of the recipes have been published in various cookbooks before, but I'm sort of updating them. And then where each one comes with a grocery list, and each one, we have a photo. We're shooting all the photos in my house. I'm picking the recipes, buying the groceries, styling the food.
Wow.
Picking the plates, doing the prop styling too, which I haven't done for, I never did the prop styling, but I did do the food styling years ago when I was in the test kitchen at Gourmet before I became the executive chef. And so it's been really, really fun also because I'm paying for it. So I'm in the driver's seat. I'm working with a very young photographer named Jessica Leibowitz who has started a little website called My Camera Eats Food. And she's a young gal.
Oh, that's good. That's
she's
very
working
clever.
As a food photographer, I mean, learning how, assisting other food photographers. I thought, well, this is fun. She'd probably like to do this and wouldn't be that expensive. Because she's doing it, and I can't afford much more. I mean, she's doing it for the first time, and she'll get credit. And we're having a great time. But at the end of the day, not that I'm a fascist, but I really want to do this photograph differently. So for the three cookbooks that I've been involved in that have been published already, I didn't feel like I had that much control over the photography because the publisher was paying for it. I was. And the style of photography, as you well know, is to get, it's almost very abstract. It's almost like art, but not mouth-watering food art. It's more like abstract food art. And you know, so you only shoot a corner of the picture, or the food's already been dissected, or there's crumbs all over the table.
Yeah, the crumbs are the thing. I've been getting a lot of half, almost all-eaten desserts with crumbs.
Yeah. And I'm like, wait a second. To me, food always is served within a context, and the context that I like to suggest is that it's served as part of a meal of a family, or at least two people eating together, or even just one person eating together, but it's not just a meal, it's a moment. It's at the end of the day, and you sit down, and you dine, and you reflect, and you enjoy. So I don't like this sort of abstract stuff. So I've been working hard for the most part, as much as I can, because these photos are tiny.
Well, stick to your guns.
I am. That has been really fun.
Would you also just zip us an email to tell us when it's available, when it's finished, and when it's available, and we'll post a note on it.
That That's great. That's great.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And I'll have to consult with you on how to do an app, because everybody wants us to do one. I have no idea how to
do this.
Well,
I'll just put you on to my web designer, because she's the one who's doing it for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's wonderful talking to you, Sarah.
Hey,
here, Anne. And hello to everybody in the Big Apple. And hopefully I'll see you at another food and wine event soon.
Yes. That was fun seeing you in Charles.
Yes. Thanks a lot, Sarah.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this week's program, and we'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.